Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Welcome to another episode of your Storybox podcast, where I, your esteemed host, Jay Phantom, has the utmost privilege and honor to unbox amazing stories from incredible people twice a week. I'm delighted and grateful that you're here today. Now let's dive into the story box and hear more about our guest today. Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of the Story Box podcast. It is episode 43 this time and I have a very special guest for you on the show. Her name is Dr. Holly Richmond. Now if you don't know who Dr. Holly is, she is a somatic psychologist, certified sex therapist and licensed marriage and family therapist. This unique combination of professional credentials enables her to focus on clients' cognitive processes as well as their somatic body-based health. Dr. Holly is one of North America's leading sex therapists, serving women, men, couples, gender-diverse individuals for relationship and sexual issues. Dr. Holly has been featured on the New York Times, WebMD, NBC, Netflix, InStyle, Vice, PopSugar, MHM, the Oprah magazine. She's been featured in Cosmopolitan, Forbes, Glamour, Men's Health, Women's Health, CNN, Wired, Venture Best, Shape, you name it. She is a highly sought after individual and for good reason. She is quite intelligent, quite smart, and she knows exactly what she's talking about. And I was really privileged, I should say, to actually get to speak with her and talk about all things relating to sexual health issues with trauma. We also talk about justice and achieving justice for sexual abuse victims. Can we actually achieve it? What is love? Is love important for having sex? Is intimacy necessary? What is intimacy and the importance of that with love versus sex? Education and sex. So do you need to be educated in order to have sex, or is it just a primal instinct that we just go for? Porn and relationships. That's a very important one that you all need to hear, and Dr. Holly's advice on that. What age do you need to be in order to be educated about sex? So Dr. Holly gives her advice on that. Should young people at a young age be watching porn? She shares more insight into that. How many years does it actually take to become a sexologist or sex therapist? The challenges involved with being a sexologist, the lessons that Dr. Holly has learned over the years. Dr. Holly has actually had more than three careers. So being a sexologist is her third career. So we dive a little bit deeper into that. And do we know the root cause of why a person will go and rape another person? So these are just some of the topics that we cover in this episode of the Story Box. We dive deep and I'm really glad we did because Dr. Holly is very, very wise and very smart and she was able to answer all the questions that I threw at her. And anyway, guys, I'm going to be quiet now because this is an awesome episode, so I want you guys to get a lot out of it. So without me going on and on and on, let's dive into the Story Box and hear Dr. Holly's story. Welcome so much to the Storybox podcast, Dr. Holly.
I am so thrilled to be here. Thank you so much, Jay. And again, thank you for getting up early or staying up very late, whichever way you want to look at it.
It's absolutely my pleasure, Dr. Holly. I've been looking forward to this conversation for quite some time now. And I know we did have to rearrange our schedules a little bit, but we're here now, which is the main thing. I'm excited once again, but before we get stuck into, I guess, this your backstory and why you do what you do, I have one question that I love asking people, and that is, what is your definition of success?
That's a fantastic question. It's really day-to-day happiness and almost happiness in the present moment instead of always projecting out in the future. So for me, it's staying present, being able to be happy in that moment. I'm just like, this has been my work lately of not attaching happiness to financial success. Of course, money is important, but I've been looking more at like, what do I want my life to look like? Not how much money do I want to make?
Mm. Where do you think this idea of success came from for you? Was it a gradual thing over time, or was there sort of a catalyst moment somewhere in your life that sort of made you realize this is success for me?
Yeah, that's a good question too. I think like many people have had a lot of money at certain points of my life and not so much money at certain points of my life. So I just celebrated my 50th birthday.
Oh, wow.
So,
you don't look it. At all.
Thank you. Thank you. I think now from, you know, this position, looking back, I can't say the most happiness was tied to the most money. Certainly, like not even close. So it's really taking it all in, that collective approach. What does happiness mean to me? You know, I have children now. Like it's a bigger picture than instead of being focused on one thing.
Mm, that's a good answer. Now I want to get into, I guess, your history. Did you always want to be a sexologist? And obviously the big question is, what does a sexologist do?
Yeah. So the answer is no. I didn't. This is my third career. So I'll tell you about the other two, but this is my third career. And I think this is the one that's going to stick for sure because I love it. So for me, a sex therapist, from my perspective, and here in the States, you have to have some kind of qualifying degree. So whether it's a master's or a PhD in psychology. Yep. So I got a PhD in somatic psychology, which means body psychology. So I pay as much attention to what my clients are telling me as to body language, symptoms, how those symptoms are presenting somatically or physiologically. Mm. And then I layered on the certificate in sex therapy. So I do still just do psychology counseling. So anxiety, depression, OCD, things like that. But most of my work is focused around relationships and healthy sexuality.
Wow. And was it hard to get the degree? Or how many years does it take to actually get a degree in sexology or?
Yeah. So all in, so the beginning of my master's until the end of my PhD and the sex therapy certification was 6.5 years.
What?
Yeah.
That is a long time. And you said this is your third career.
What were the other two
and what made you go into this?
Yeah. So that's a bit of a story. So the first one, you can probably see me flushing. I get embarrassed because I don't love to talk about it. And not many people know this. I started modeling when I was 15 and a half. So I was a professional model in New York and in London from 15 and a half until I went back for my bachelor's to college at 19, but still did it a little bit through college. Mm. And then went into magazine publishing. So I was an editor and a writer for 14 years for women's magazines, men's magazines. I was the West Coast fashion editor for 17 magazine. So did all just kind of lifestyle, beauty, fashion, things like that. And then the psychology has been my third career.
So were you quite high up with the magazine editing?
It was, I worked for myself. So I started my own company when I was 29. I've literally worked for myself since I was 29 years old and freelanced. So I did okay. But then remember the 2008 economic collapse. So what I was making for print journalism, all of a sudden those rates just got cut like crazy. So that was a precipitating factor for me going back. But more so than that, it was just that I was kind of done writing about fashion, beauty, health, fitness, celebrity profiles. Like it sounds great. And there were aspects of it that were great, but I literally remember sitting at my desk one morning and I got an article assignment from my editor on lip gloss. Mm. And this was probably like the 12th article I had written on lip gloss in my career. And I was just like, if I have to write one more article about lip gloss, I'm going to lose my damn mind. Like it's just going to be over.
Wow.
So I started making the change.
So that's interesting because of all the things you decided to choose, you went into this path of, I guess, as a sex therapist, which is very, very interesting to me at least because it's a very, very, it's a topic that a lot of people love talking about, but they're very, very closed off to it at the same time, if that makes sense. So it's kind of like very nerve-wracking for a lot of people to open up about their sexual relationships and intimacy and all that sort of stuff. So why did you choose being a sex therapist?
Yeah. And when I started my master's in clinical psych, this was not on my mind at all, really. The direction, the seed was planted. But so Jay, when I got the lip gloss article, I was like, oh my gosh, I cannot do this anymore. I need to do something bigger picture. Mm. I started teaching at a girls' correctional facility in Southern California. Wow. I had read a book that literally changed my life. It was called True Notebooks by Mark Salzman. And he went into boys' detention facilities in the LA area and taught creative writing. And it changed his life. It changed the boy's life. And it just felt so important for me to do that. So I found a position, taught once or twice a week for a couple of years, and then decided to get my master's in clinical psychology. The sex therapy piece really was born out of that work with the girls in the prison system. As they were writing to me, they were just writing story after story of sexual abuse, sexual assault, gang rape. And they would write it like, I was leaving school, I got jumped by my brother's gang, his friend raped me, and then I went and met my friend at the 7-Eleven. Just wow. Like, you know, boom, 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 like very little affect attached to it, just because it was kind of normalized in their life. And it was devastating to me. And I realized I didn't have the tools. Like, I was just teaching creative writing. I didn't have the tools to really help. So in graduate school, I chose to do my 3,000 hours at a rape crisis center. Wow. So that's really, that was the beginning of this.
That sounds like a massive challenge and quite eye-opening to me.
It was
such an emotional turmoil experience having to hear someone go through that. And then they're telling you it's kind of normalized in their life.
Right.
So how does someone actually help a person get over that? I mean, that seems like a massive hurdle to get across.
It is. And I think one of the lessons I learned as a younger therapist was I was trying to help them get over it. Mm. And you never can. Like, for most people who experience any kind of sexual trauma of that nature, there's no getting over it. It's a getting through it, seeing how you might come out stronger on the other side, the gifts you can give to other people, really taking the judgment off yourself. Mm. It's amazing. And this is not just about women, but how often the survivor herself or himself gets blamed. Mm. And I think with the Me Too movement, we're starting to say, hold on a minute, it's not the survivor's fault. Like, we really need to start putting the blame where it belongs, which is on the perpetrators. Mm. So I hope there's been a little bit of a sea change with that, but it really is just, so many survivors are like, oh, I shouldn't have been in that neighborhood. Why did I get so drunk? Mm. The only reason people get raped is because there was a rapist present.
Yeah.
Right? You know, most people who would see a young drunk girl would help her.
Mm. Mm. Exactly.
Yeah. So it's just giving that perspective.
Yeah, that's good. In your perspective, and having done a lot of sessions with a lot of different people, I'm curious to know, in your opinion, what do you think causes someone to rape another person?
Oof, my gosh. It's almost always about power and control. Mm. But we have to examine the sexual lens, because if it was just about power or control, they could beat them up. They could rob them, right? Mm. But it's a sexual assault, which by its very nature is more intrusive. It's bodily, it's mind, and it's body. Mm. You've probably heard this phrase, hurt people hurt people.
Yep.
So a lot of times perpetrators have been sexually abused or assaulted in their past, and then that chain just continues on and on and on. And that's not an excuse. We all have free will. We all know the difference between right and wrong. Again, I think societally we're really learning to put the blame where it belongs, and perpetrators are now in a lot of ways getting what they deserve. Weinstein, for example, you know, in prison now. So it's finally, I feel like it's finally, we're getting the results that we want.
Mm. Why do you think it's taken so long, in your opinion, for society to actually get on board with, okay, this needs to actually change. We need to do something about this. There are, because it's almost like, when a woman comes out and says that I've been sexually abused by a man, where's the evidence? Are you going to believe, who are you going to believe? So there's always that question of, it's questionable doubt, really.
Right.
So how do you know if someone has actually been sexually abused?
That's a great question. And I don't think we ever can. I can tell you, like, the rates of false reporting are under 5%. So I think the patriarchy, I'm just going to put it at that, the powers that be love to say, oh, it's probably a false accusation because she wants money because of this and that. The research shows us that's a very small amount. And in the he said, she said, many times the he said is in a much higher position of power or money. And it's hard to prove these things, right? So, and over 85% of survivors know their perpetrator. So let's say that she went on a date with him and let's say she went back to his room. You know, what's the jury going to do with it? Yeah, but you said you were, you went back to his room. So it's really, it's not easy. But I think the collective voice of the Me Too movement helped people see, like, really, we need to believe women. We need to believe men who have been assaulted. There's really no good reason to press charges if you weren't. It's a hell of a battle. Like, it's horrible for any survivor that's ever been through the legal system trying to fight this. You would not sign up for this unless this was the truth.
No.
Again, back to Me Too, that one, they got the guy because there were so many voices. In most cases of sexual assault, though, or date rape, there's only two voices. He said, she said, or she said, she said, he said, he said. And you're absolutely right. It is hard to be proven not guilty. I mean, guilty.
Which I've been saying, I don't know if you saw as well, but that young boy, young black kid that was shot in broad daylight.
Yeah.
The reason why they got justice was because of the lawyer went online and started publicizing. So I'm starting to think, well, is there power in numbers and social media to get the right kind of justice for something like that? It seems to me that it has worked, but we'll never know. Hopefully it starts to really go in the right direction.
Yeah.
I want to
that's a great thought though.
Shift the conversation to more about this topic of love and what is love important for sex? So what do you believe about that?
Yeah. So I'm just going to wrap up that conversation. So my work with survivors was hugely important. And I got to a point where, I cannot do this 24/7. Like I love my work with survivors. It's probably 50% of the work I do now, but the sex therapy certification let me treat arousal problems, erectile dysfunction, pain during sex, fetishes, couples problems, low desire, all of these things. So like more of that holistic view of human sexuality rather than just through the lens of sexual trauma. So love, oh my gosh, love and sex. Can you say that question again? Ask me that question one more time.
So what is love and is love important for sex?
Oh my gosh, what is love? Well, we know love is not a static state. It's not, I don't think it's something you feel. It's really, you can't quantify it. It's behavior, it's feeling. It's all of those physiological cues we get. It's putting someone at least on the same level as yourself, or sometimes even above yourself, and still having that piece of self-care. Is it necessary for sex? 100% no. But from everything I've heard and everything I've experienced in my life, when it's present during sex, it makes sex that much better.
It's an interesting thought, because if we were to unpack love, I've been told all my life that in order for you to have the best sex you've ever had, you have to fall in love with that person, because there's a deeper understanding of them. It's a deeper connection. So that's interesting that you said that in order to have sex, you don't really need to have love. It's very fascinating. So how does that play for, is intimacy a similar thing? Or is intimacy a difference with love and sex?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I want to say intimacy, love, and sex have to be defined by the individual themselves. So how I define it is going to be different than how you define it. So sex, we're really pulling back on that definition of penetration, anything for a lot of us, it's like, oh, it's only sex if there's penetration involved. And now, at least through the sex therapy lens, sex is from start to finish, foreplay to aftercare, all of these things, mm-hmm. Which is part of intimacy, which can be part of love. Intimacy, I think intimacy, if you, you know, you've probably heard this too, if you break that word down, it's into me see, right? It's like a looking, like you see me, I see you. It's about more than this physical body. It's about our passion, our expression, who we are as people, what we bring to the table, what we bring to the bedroom. So intimacy, I think, is compassion, connection, being able to communicate well, and feeling cared for.
Mm. So how does someone actually, I guess, have good sex in the first place? Like, is it there, this education, does that need to be involved, or are we just primal instincts designed to just, you know, go at it in very raw terms?
I think that's a great question. It can work that way. It works much better with sex education. I want to just back up a little bit and say, for some people, they would only be able to have good sex if they were in love with the person. For other people, they can only have good sex if they barely know the person. Right? Because there's a level of vulnerability when you have sex with someone you love versus having sex with a stranger. Like, I don't really care what you think of me. So some people need to have that no vulnerability space because it's just sex is too much for them. And they prefer it that way. Back to the sex education. Since, you know, the advent of porn really being online and so accessible, we've seen a downtick in sex education and an uptick in what young people especially think sex should be. And they think it's much more performance based than pleasure based. So that's the duality that we're working with. Porn is all about performance. These are literally actors. They're lit well. The film is edited and cut. They've just, you know, they've got all the bells and whistles. Versus pleasure is not performance based. It's just what feels good to you, what feels good to your partner, which is going to be different than what feels good to her friend, what feels good to me, what feels good to my partner. Right. So like, pleasure is a very personal experience.
I'll get to the porn epidemic in a moment, because I feel like that is a huge problem in society today. So what age do you believe is the appropriate age to learn everything they need to know about sex?
From the sex education point of view, it should probably start around 13 in the schools. I don't know what's happening in Australia now, but we basically don't have it here in the US anymore. And if it is, it's just like basic anatomy. It's about the egg. It's about semen. It's about periods. It's about condoms.
Yeah.
Right. That's about it. It's a lot of don't do this. It's nothing about pleasure.
So why do you think it's a lot of don't do this? And I have another curious question. It just came back to me, actually. Mm-hmm. So this idea of connection and sex, like we mentioned before, in order to, like, for some people, they just want to have sex and not feel attached to that person. Is that actually possible though? Because when you have sex, it's like two people coming together as one. It's a very deep. So can that person like not fall in love when they actually have sex, or is that not possible?
Oh, it's absolutely possible. And that's what, you know, the sex industry thrives on, right?
Yeah.
So it's about having pleasure for pleasure's sake. Of course, being kind and compassionate, whatever your partner wants, like having the agreement be explicit about what both people want out of the exchange, whether it is just sex or whether there's a deeper meaning to it and something after that.
Because when I was in school, I was exposed to porn at age 12. Now, that was a huge curious thing for me, because I was interested in the human body, specifically the female body. And I was like, okay, well, this is fascinating. And it drew my interest into it. And nowadays we're seeing, with the advent of, I guess, websites, the whole bit, it's easily accessible for a lot of young people. And in schools nowadays, they're not really educated properly on it, here in Australia, that is, on proper sex and how to perform and intimacy and the whole bit. And they get their education now from porn. And so we have a lot of all this performance anxiety as a result of it. We have a lot more sexual abuse because literally porn is violent. There is a lot of violence associated with porn. And it's sort of like they have all these issues that stem from watching porn. Because I know, because I had the same problem growing up. But then when I learned to get over it and transition my thought process differently, it changed my perspective, changed everything for me. So what strategies, in your opinion, would you give to a young person that is struggling with porn at the moment and needs help? And why should we not watch porn?
Oh, that's a tough question. There's so many things I want to say right now. For a young person, like if we're talking a 13, 14 year old, yeah, they probably shouldn't be watching porn, but we know they are. I think some of the most recent research said 9 or 10 years old is the first exposure to porn, which is shocking. So again, it comes back to that education piece, and that now has to be on the parents. So I think if we're going to pull away from porn for these very young people, the onus is on the parents to have those difficult conversations with your tweens before you want to, before you think they want to, but you have to tell them yes about pregnancy, yes about pleasure, about what they can expect from their bodies, about how to treat their partner. All of those things are incredibly important. So not pathologizing any aspect of sexuality, but kind of like pumping up the idea of pleasure and connection. And this can be about love, or it can just be about pleasure, but you and your partner need to be on the same page about that.
Mm. So how do we deal with performance anxiety for someone?
Yeah, I work with that a lot. So again, like with men with erectile issues, we need to know, is that problem organic or is it psychogenic? So the organic would be there's a physiological cause. The psychogenic would be more the performance anxiety or an anxiety related issue. There's a lot of ways to deal with that. So if I'm working with someone who does feel like they have compulsive porn use, we work to titrate that down, help them use their imagination more, maybe even reading erotica. But I love the power of the imagination because it's better than any porn could ever be. And we know masturbation is normal. It's natural. It's actually good for men. If you're not having sex, reduces, you know, masturbation and ejaculation reduces rates of prostate cancer. So I would never want to pathologize masturbation, but the porn use for very young people can certainly be problematic. But it's just, again, what's real sex and what's produced sex, right?
With this idea of, I guess, masturbation is good for men, I'm curious to know, because like for arousal and that, oftentimes men do turn to porn if they're not having sex as a way to sort of stimulate and pleasure themselves to actually get to that erectile state, or the finished state at least. So what would you say to that man, and why is it dangerous to actually, or is it dangerous actually to watch porn if you're not having sex to actually pleasure your own self?
Yeah, I don't think it's dangerous at all to watch porn if you're not having sex, or if you are having sex. I have so many couples that use porn together just as another interesting tool. Porn is only, I mean, porn is in and of itself isn't dangerous. It's how we use it, right? Like porn just lives on the internet. I don't think there's anything, unless someone is being abused in it or unless underage people are in it. But for the most part, on the larger websites, Pornhub, YouPorn, they're really monitoring and making sure everything is at least with 18 and above people. The problem with porn comes with compulsivity. So if someone is masturbating so much that that's getting in the way of other healthy aspects of their life, are they showing up late for work? Are they not going to work? Can they not maintain a healthy relationship because they only feel comfortable touching themselves now and are, aren't comfortable with another person. So those are the dangers. And when I, again, when I work with this, I just encourage the person to use their imagination more. I'll set them up on a whole protocol. It would take probably 8 to 10 weeks, but I've had great results. So it's not about no porn. It's just about finding a level of porn that really helps you live your healthiest life.
It's interesting because why is porn not bad in that respect? Because I know for some couples, and I've spoken with some couples, they feel almost like the man or woman is actually cheating with another person when they're either watching it or pleasuring themselves to another human being that's on a screen. So it's kind of a form of cheating. Do you see it that way?
I don't see it that way, but a lot of my clients do. And it's something I work with all the time. So it's really like breaking that down. And if the couple comes to an agreement, like no porn, then it should be no porn. And I want to help them move towards that goal. But I definitely have a ton of couples that watch porn together, and it's a huge erotic part of their sex lives. So again, it's just in how you view it personally and how the couple uses it individually or together.
So this idea of why do you think that people turn to other sources of, I guess, arousal, satisfaction, or orgasmic experiences if they can't actually get pleasure with one person?
Novelty. It's just about novelty. Novelty is really one of the seats of human desire. We crave what we don't know. We crave newness and freshness. After 30 or 40 years with the same person, that can be hard to cultivate unless, again, you're really using your imagination and working hard on making the relationship new. So it's just continuing to grow with each other. But I think in a lot of ways, porn, I don't want to say solves that problem, but it seems like an easy, you know, a fairly easy fix to the problem. But some people use video games. Some people watch Netflix all day long. You know, we don't hear anybody talking about Netflix addiction. But it, to me, it's like any kind of external distraction that's a threat to the relationship needs to be discussed. It's just porn is easy to pathologize. And I 100% understand some of the reasons that you're concerned about. But it can also be used for pleasure.
It's a very interesting thought because I've had some very fascinating conversations with other sexologists as well. And we've sort of dived into this thought of why, I guess, porn is an epidemic today and why a lot of people actually go to it. And one of the main things is because it is attractive to a lot of people. And if they can access it for free, it's sort of like, why not? You know, like, where's the harm? And they don't really see the neurological pathways that it changes. I know for me, and what it did for me was it made me feel like less of a man. It made me think that sex was a certain way when it really wasn't. And it made me, I guess, just the performance aspect. I was sort of wanting it to be something that I had seen. But then it just impacted the creativity aspect, which was hard for me to sort of get rid of that barrier and actually use my creativity. Which when I did, it was much better for my own personal life, and I felt better as a result because I wasn't going to some other external source. And yeah, so anyway. Have you had any?
I love your stories.
Yeah, it's like I was just unhappy. Like I've kept going back to this source that wasn't. It didn't make me feel good after, if that made sense. Like it just it was like this repetition of constant feeling like I needed to use porn as a way to make me feel good. If it made sense, make me feel like a man, or educate me, but it wasn't that at all. So it's just an interesting thought process with this whole idea of porn, and I appreciate you sharing your thoughts on it. Because I like hearing the different perspectives, and then people can make a choice whether or not they want to believe which side. So, have you had any challenges or difficulties being a sexologist?
No, I don't think so. So far, so good. It's just, it's been, I mean, some days are tough. High conflict couples, that's always, you know, those are always hard to work with because I want people to be happy and to leave feeling good. Some relationships can't, you know, there's no saving them. So the right thing, the best thing is for people to separate. And that's hard. But there's really so far nothing too much yet. And yes, the porn is a very divisive issue. So that's, it's something that I'm dealing with all the time. But I think where you started when you were introducing me, like my sex positive approach, all sex is good sex as long as it's consensual and pleasurable. For some people, that's inclusive of porn. For some people, it's not. Your story is very, like, it's just spot on for what can happen and what can go wrong. So again, it's, I wish you had had the education at 11 or 12 that, hey, porn is just a movie. Like, that's literally not real. If you want to watch it just like you would watch Star Wars or anything else for the entertainment value, great. But do not translate that into real life or real relationships because it won't work.
Where did you come up with that saying? All sex is good sex if it's
consensual and pleasurable. I heard it at a conference and I wish I know exactly who I heard it from, but part of my sex therapy training is continuing education credits all the time. So I go to an annual conference with someone very smart there. But it just helps, you know, because people come to me with pretty strong fetishes that they're feeling horrible about. And if I could just like break that down under the umbrella of, is it consensual and is it pleasurable? Then in some ways it can let them off the hook. If they're just feeling bad about it, like they're hurting someone or something, you know, then I can check those two boxes and help them feel better. And then again, like porn, pull it out when you want to pull it out, but it's not a must. It's a choice. Everything about sexuality should be a choice.
That's very, very interesting. I like that. Yeah. So I do want to be mindful of your time. So I do have a few more questions for you.
Yeah.
In terms of creating a healthy relationship, what are the musts that you need to create a healthy relationship with someone?
It's a wonderful question. Appreciation, I think, should be at the top. Far too often we take our partners for granted. I love daily appreciation. So knowing, does your partner love to hear you look fantastic today? Or does your partner need to hear, thank you so much for cooking breakfast this morning? Does your partner need a little gift surprise in their pocket? You know, what does your partner respond to? So really learning how they communicate and appreciating them for it. The other thing, of course, is talking. One of the biggest pieces that's still missing with healthy sexuality is good communication about it. So I know for a fact couples have better sex when they can communicate openly about it. So I would say the appreciation and communication are probably two of the that are top on my list.
They're good. I like those. Now, in terms of I guess if you could go back and when this all started for you and tell yourself one thing, what would you tell yourself and why?
Oh my gosh. To trust the process, because I feel like I came into this without my North Star at all. You know, it was just like, okay, the girls in prison led to a master's in clinical psych, led to the sex therapy certification. I had no idea back then that I would be doing what I'm doing now and the amazing people that I'm getting to meet and the companies I've been able to work with and how women's pleasure in particular has just really come to the forefront of my career and a message that I want to get out there. The way survivors' lives are changing because of the Me Too movement. No one could have seen all of that. And I feel so blessed to be a part of it. So I think when I get anxious and I project out into the future and imagine all of the possible things that could go wrong, it's just to dial myself back and say, trust the process.
That's good. Two more questions for you, if you don't mind. What are some things that you are passionate about outside of being a therapist?
Oh, I, full disclosure, I have two young boys. So a lot of my non-work time is family time, but just, I love being active. I've been an athlete my whole life. So still love doing outdoorsy things, love time with my family. We live just outside of New York City now. There's always something to do. So really just taking in different cultures and different people, traveling when we can. I told you, you know, everybody in my household is an Australian. So we love getting to Australia when we can. So yeah, it's just for me, I crave novelty a lot. So I love being able to do different things.
That's cool. My last question for you is, you've reached the ripe old age of 100 and your friends have all created a mixtape for you of everything you've ever said and everything you've ever done. And they show it to you on your 100th birthday. What do you want that mixtape to show and say?
Oh, that it's not too late, that you're not too old. Yeah, I that's definitely been a concern of mine because it's my third career and you know, I didn't even start the psychology part of my journey until my late 30s. I always have that sense like I came to this too late. I'm too old, you know, to do this. We live in such a world of commodification of youth and beauty and all of those things. So just leaning into the wisdom and the experience that I have.
That's amazing. I feel like that is a great way to sort of end that conversation. I feel like I could talk to you for ages. I have so many more questions. We have to do this again sometime. But thank you so much, Dr. Holly, for coming on the Storybox podcast, sharing your journey with us as well, and also your advice. Really do appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And yes, anytime, I'm happy to rejoin.
Thank you. I don't like this part because it means that sadly we have come to an end of yet another incredible story. I just want to say thank you to all of you for tuning in and listening to our guest today. It is my prayer that you would have felt inspired, motivated, challenged in some way, and that you would have learned something new as well. If you would like to hear more amazing stories like this one, you can do so now by searching up the Storybox on any podcast platform. It's that easy. If you did get something from our guest today, please share it around to a friend or family member that you think could benefit from hearing this powerful story. And before you go, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It will only take 30 seconds and it'll go towards reaching more people. Let's start changing lives through powerful stories like this one. Your support is greatly appreciated. Until next time, when we dive back into the story box, I'm Jay Phantom, and don't forget, your story is worth more than you know. I'll catch you next time.